Hello, this is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And during the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. The center staff conducts innovative research and other programs in health and nutrition, and they provide consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and by foundation grants. It accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, which was first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. In a special feature published in the May 2011 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter, senior nutritionist David Shart discusses the evidence regarding green tea's health effects. Green tea is hot. You can buy a bottled green tea beverage just about anywhere these days. And food manufacturers are adding green tea or its extracts to everything from coffee. One 8 o'clock coffee blend has compounds from green tea, quote, gently infused into its beans. To juice drinks, V8V Fusion contains, quote, the natural goodness of green tea. So how good is the evidence that green tea is good for your health? Studies in laboratory animals are impressive, but compelling evidence in humans has been hard to come by. Drinking tea regularly may be one of the most practical lifestyle changes you can make to significantly reduce your risk of suffering a stroke, says epidemiologist Lenore Arab of the University of California at Los Angeles. Arab co-chaired the 4th International Scientific Symposium on Tea and Human Health in 2007. She and her colleagues pooled the results from 10 studies of nearly 200,000 people in China, Japan, Finland, the Netherlands, Australia, and the United States. Studies that looked at tea consumption and stroke risk. The meta-analysis was funded by Unilever, which owns Lipton. The benefit of drinking tea came shining through no matter where people lived in the world, says Dr. Arab. Those who drank at least 3 cups every day had a 21% lower risk of suffering a stroke compared with those who drank less than a cup a day. If this turns out to be true, that is pretty strong finding for something that's the third leading cause of death in this country, notes Eric Rim, director of the program in cardiovascular epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston. Dr. Rim says, because the studies that Arab's team examined were not designed to prove cause and effect. There is a strong association, but we do not know if there's something about the people who drink tea that would account for their having fewer strokes, explains Rachel Johnson, a professor of nutrition at the University of Vermont. and a spokesperson for the American Stroke Association. What is needed, she says, is a trial that randomly assigns people to drink either tea or an indistinguishable tea-free placebo. And if tea matters, is green tea better than black tea? Green tea comes from the unfermented leaves of the plant Camellia sinensis, while black tea is made from the fermented leaves. In Arab's meta-analysis, green tea was not better than black. But in animal studies, compounds in green tea called polyphenols seem to protect lab animals against damage caused by strokes. For example, when researchers induce strokes in gerbils, Dr. Arab explains, the animal's brain suffer less damage if they are first fed a tea polyphenol called EGCG. If the same is true in humans, green tea may help stop strokes from becoming severe enough to be noticed. So-called silent strokes are common, and they are far less damaging than major strokes. At least 10% of people older than 65 have damage to the white matter of their brains, which is probably evidence of silent strokes that did not cause paralysis or pain or other symptoms that would lead them to be diagnosed with stroke, says Dr. Arab. When I'm asked, when is the best time to drink tea? I say right before your stroke, she jokes. So, should you start drinking 3 cups of green tea every day to protect your brain? Well, it's far too early to say. It is much more important to keep your blood pressure under control by shedding pounds if you are overweight, by eating less salt and more fruits and vegetables, and by taking blood pressure-lowering drugs, if necessary. The evidence that green tea prevents the development of prostate cancer in men is not very encouraging, says researcher Suzanne Henning of the Center for Human Nutrition at the University of California at Los Angeles. For example, in 4 studies that followed more than 95,000 men in Japan and Hawaii for 7 to 20 years, those who drank the most tea had no lower overall risk of being diagnosed with prostate cancer than those who drank the least amount of tea. But for men with or at high risk of prostate cancer, tea may make a difference, says Dr. Henning. I would definitely advise them to drink large amounts of green tea, because it may slow down the progression of the disease. Only 1 of the 4 studies in Japanese and Hawaiian men looked at the risk of advanced prostate cancer separately. It found that those who drank 5 or more cups of green tea a day had half the risk of those who drank less than a cup a day. And then there's a 2006 Italian study whose results were remarkable, says Hassan Mukhtar, a professor of cancer research at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Researchers recruited 60 men with high-grade prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, or PIN, lesions, some of which turn into prostate cancer. Half of the men were given 600 milligrams a day of a green tea extract. Half were given a placebo. After 1 year, 10 of the men had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. 9 of those were in the placebo group. Only 1 of them had been taking the green tea extract. It was a nice study, but it was pretty small, says tea researcher Joshua Lambert of Pennsylvania State University. It needs to be confirmed by larger intervention studies, and several trials are in the works. 5 years ago, UCLA's Dr. Henning started giving men who were awaiting surgery to remove their cancerous prostate 5 cups of green tea, black tea, or water every day. She's looking at whether the tea has any impact on their PSA levels, that is, prostate-specific antigen levels, or on the cancer cells in their prostate. PSA levels may reflect the growth of prostate cancer. And in 2007, researchers at the Moffitt Cancer Center and Research Institute in Tampa, Florida, began giving green tea extracts to men with high-grade PIN lesions. And they expect to complete their study by the end of this year. Cohort studies that follow women for years really do not show any protective effect from drinking tea on the risk of developing breast cancer, says Anna Wu, co-leader of the Cancer Control Research Program at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine in Los Angeles. In the 6 studies that tracked more than 140,000 women in Japan, Sweden, the Netherlands, and the United States for up to 24 years, those who reported drinking the most tea were no less likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer than those who drank the least amount of tea. But green tea may make a difference in women who already have breast cancer. In 2 studies of Japanese women who had been diagnosed with breast cancer, those who drank more than 3 cups of green tea every day had a 27% lower risk of having their cancer recur than those who drank little or no green tea. That's far from proof, though. The problem in interpreting studies like these is that drinking green tea is an indicator of an Asian lifestyle, including lower body weight, more physical activity, and more soy in the diet, points out Regina Ziegler, a researcher at the U.S. National Cancer Institute and a member of Nutrition Action's Scientific Advisory Board. So it could be that this lifestyle, rather than drinking green tea, helped protect these women from getting breast cancer again. 8 o'clock Metabolism Boost Performance Blend coffee beans are gently infused with 40 to 70 milligrams of the polyphenol EGCG per brewed cup, quote, to naturally enhance the body's own metabolism. And General Nutrition Center's Be Energized Calorie Burning Formula supplements its 200 milligrams of caffeine with 25 milligrams of EGCG, the polyphenol, to boost your metabolism. So, does EGCG, a polyphenol found in green tea, make you burn more calories? If you test the tea polyphenols like EGCG alone, you do not see that they have very much of an effect on metabolism, says researcher Mario Ferruzzi of Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. They don't appear to do much for weight either. A recent meta-analysis found that overweight men and women who consumed 282 milligrams of EGCG every day weighed no less after 12 weeks than similar people who took a placebo. If you combine tea polyphenols with caffeine, you do see a bump in short-term energy expenditure compared to people taking just caffeine or a placebo, notes Dr. Ferruzzi. Whether that helps you maintain a healthy weight is a whole other issue. Dr. Ferruzzi, by the way, is a co-patent holder for a weight maintenance drink that contains tea and caffeine, and that was the basis for Coca-Cola's Envigo drink. In the meta-analysis, the mix of EG, CG, and caffeine was not very impressive. After 3 months of taking polyphenols plus caffeine every day, overweight men and women, some were dieting and some were not, lost an average of just one more pound than similar people who took a placebo. Small and not likely clinically relevant was the way the researchers summed up their results. Regular tea drinkers may experience a different rate of cognitive decline than non-tea drinkers, says UCLA epidemiologist Lenore Arab. Dr. Arab and her colleagues analyzed data from the cardiovascular health study, which has been tracking heart disease and stroke rates in adults 65 years of age and older in North Carolina, California, Maryland, and Pennsylvania since 1989. More than 4,800 of the study participants took a yearly mini mental state examination, a questionnaire that is used to screen for memory loss and other cognitive impairment. Those who drank tea, green or black, at least five times a week had about a 30% slower rate of decline in their scores than those who did not drink tea at all. But so did those who drank tea just one to three times a month. So it's not clear whether tea, rather than something else about tea drinkers, protects the brain. The results, which were presented at an Alzheimer's disease conference last summer, have not been published. An earlier long-term study among older Chinese adults living in Singapore also found that tea drinkers had a slower rate of cognitive decline than non-tea drinkers. Dr. Arab's bottom line is this: we are still very early in the game. We are not there yet in terms of saying anything that is definitive. So, here's the bottom line. Green tea is rich in plant compounds that help protect laboratory animals from cancer and other diseases. But the jury is still out over whether it helps protect humans against cancer, strokes, or cognitive decline. If you want the full range of potentially beneficial compounds in green tea, drink it freshly brewed and often. And if you drink bottled tea, look for one made primarily from brewed green tea, not from tea extracts or concentrates. In a special feature entitled Gluten-Free Confusion, Separating Fact from Fiction, Nutrition Action Health Letter Director of Nutrition, Bonnie Liebman, reports concerning the nature and incidence of gluten intolerance and celiac disease. The report results from Ms. Liebman's interview of Dr. Joseph Murray, a gastroenterologist and professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Murray is a senior associate editor of the American Journal of Gastroenterology, and he is the author of a recent study of the rising incidence of celiac disease. Regarding the incidence of celiac disease, Dr. Murray says that the incidence has increased dramatically in the U.S. since 1950 and now affects 1% of the population. There is good evidence that we are not just getting better at detecting celiac disease. It is also increasing in other countries, even in places where it was historically common, like Finland. And celiac disease occurs at every age. It occurs out of the blue in elderly people as well as in children. Why is celiac disease increasing? Well, there are many theories. For example, something may have changed in the way we grow, process, and eat wheat that may have affected our likelihood of getting celiac disease. There is a drive to provide higher gluten wheat because that's what makes bread springy and makes a good sliced loaf. And the ongoing breeding to generate new strains that are disease resistant or higher yield, that is a prime suspect. What causes celiac disease? If you have a genetic predisposition, your T cells, that is your T lymphocytes, start to see gluten as an enemy. Think of your body's immune system as the FBI. And once it sees gluten as an enemy, it sets up what we call a memory response. It's like the TSA watch list for people who fly. Once you're on it, it's very hard to get off. Once you are tagged by the immune system, you are tagged forever. You can go off gluten for a year, and your intestine can heal. But once it gets gluten back, bam, here it comes again. The gluten probably gets changed by one of our human enzymes, called TTG, or tissue transglutaminase. So it becomes more antigenic, that is, it looks more like a foreign invader. Then the T cells get hold of it and they traffic it to the draining lymph nodes and set up an aggressive immune response. And something triggers the response. 30% of the population carries one of two versions of the gene for the disease. And essentially everybody eats gluten. Yet most of us don't get celiac disease, so something triggers it. Infection, injury to the intestine, surgery, drugs, or something else. If you have celiac disease and you keep eating gluten, the damage accelerates and you get chronic inflammation, and the body produces cytokines or chemical messengers from the inflammation that make people feel crummy. They may not even point to their gut, which is where the problem is coming from. They just say, I feel terrible. And the inflammation starts to recruit other players. And soon you've got a ruckus going on in the intestine. Eventually, it damages the lining of the intestine and your ability to absorb nutrients. It is true, probably, that most people with celiac disease have no GI symptoms. Some don't know it because they don't have any symptoms. Other people go to the doctor with anemia or other problems, but celiac disease is not suspected, so they are not tested for it. But here's the kicker. Let's say you look at people you found by doing a screening. You ask if they have got any symptoms, and they say, no, doc, I feel fine. My digestion is perfect. Then you put them on a gluten-free diet, and when you see them a year later, they say, my bowel habit is much better than it was. And you say, huh? But I thought you said you had no symptoms. What they'd accepted as normal, they now know was not. And that is pretty common with celiac disease. Some people without celiac disease also react to gluten. In 1980, researchers in England fed women with chronic diarrhea a gluten-free diet or not, and their symptoms went away on the gluten-free diet. It is not quite celiac disease, but patients have the celiac genes. They may or may not have the antibodies. They may just have slight damage in the intestine. I would call that celiac light. They have a mild version of celiac. There's also a celiac-like condition. We call it non-celiac gluten intolerance. And there's a lot of debate about it. Patients have symptoms that look like celiac disease or irritable bowel syndrome, and they get better when they go on a gluten-free diet, but they do not necessarily have the genes for celiac disease, and they do not have antibodies for celiac disease. In a very good recent study, an Australian group fed these people either a gluten-free diet or not, in a double-blind, placebo-controlled fashion. And those who were fed gluten got their symptoms back. You can think of it as gluten-sensitive irritable bowel syndrome, because it's like irritable bowel syndrome, but the symptoms get better when people go on a gluten-free diet. Some people feel better on a gluten-free diet just because they expect to. In some people, it could be that when they eat less gluten, they eat less food. And eating less is the most important advice we can give to most Americans. Or they may feel better just because they eat less junk food. If you get rid of the gluten, it's harder to eat junk. But there are plenty of gluten-free foods that are unhealthy for you. And there have been studies showing that a gluten-free diet may have less fiber and less vitamins. Many gluten-free foods are not fortified, so that is also an issue. So who should be tested for celiac disease? Dr. Murray says anybody who has a family member with celiac disease or symptoms that are suggestive of celiac disease, like iron deficiency anemia, chronic diarrhea, bloating, gas, or abdominal pain. So should people with type 1 diabetes or autoimmune diseases like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis in the family. We test for celiac disease with a blood test for antibodies to tissue transglutaminase. That's the first step. And if this test is positive, the current recommendation by virtually every organization is to get a biopsy of the lining of the small intestine. The biopsy is definitive. The results of the biopsy are definitive, as long as the patient is not already on a gluten-free diet. Stomach pain, diarrhea, weight loss are some of the symptoms of celiac disease. An autoimmune reaction to gluten, a protein found in wheat, barley, and rye. Well, folks, we've reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News. The show will be rebroadcast this week on Friday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 3 p.m. Please join me for the next edition of Nutrition News, which will air on Wednesday, March 7th, 2012. I'm Ann Weller, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I hope that you've enjoyed the show. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience, and it is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next month.